my head to one side. It clarifies somewhat. He is there. I know it. Drawing a steadying breath, I continue. For one thing, I don't think you want it any more than I do. The marriage, I mean. You said yourself that you'd not expected to see a human when you looked into the scrying water. I'm not what you had in mind for a wife. Not a real wife, anyway. You claimed me because, as you have taken pains to tell me on several occasions now, you needed me. I've been considering what that could mean, and I think... I hesitate. Now that I'm about to say the words aloud, they seem foolish. But I've come this far. I might as well finish what I've started. I think perhaps you are cursed. The shadow offers no discernible reaction. Am I mistaken in thinking I feel a quickening of interest in the air? Don't worry, I add. I've gathered already that part of your curse includes an inability to discuss it with me. I suppose I'm meant to break it somehow, but I cannot break it if I'm not told what it is and what I'm meant to do. And the year and a day you have set until the end of our marriage, that must be the deadline of the curse. Still nothing. No response. No indication that he's heard me beyond a vague prickling on the edge of my awareness. I pinch my lips together and once more look up at the sky between the shading branches overhead. I've thought about what you said, about how this house is folded into a different reality. I don't pretend to understand it exactly, but, well, if I were to venture a guess, I'd say that you and all your people here in the house with you are exiled, hiding. From what or from whom, I don't know. But if I can break this curse, then you will be able to return to your proper home. I duck my head, twisting my fingers before folding them tightly. I know how it feels, wanting to go home, I say softly. I know what it's like to be parted from those I care about. I know, that is, I suspect, if I were in your shoes, I would probably do much the same as you. I glance sidelong at the shadow. I don't know exactly what your curse is or how it is to be broken, I continue. But you have been... Here I falter. Could I say he'd been kind? Certainly not. How can I attribute kindness to my kidnapper? Courteous, I finish lamely. That much is true, at least. While I might justly protest being stolen away from home, I've been treated with great consideration and care ever since. If I can break your curse, I will. But only if... A hot flush creeps up my cheek. I turn away from the shadow, determined not to let him see it. The idea of a curse occurred to me 3 days ago, and the more I ponder it, the more convinced I am that I'm on the right track. But it was only last night, while staring into the brilliant moonfire flames on my hearth, that I realized what the solution might entail. My shadowy bridegroom needs a wife. He said as much several times over. A bride. A willing bride. Willing to take a husband she cannot see. And before the year and a day is over. I duck my head, squeezing my hands tightly together. If that is what's required, I can't do it. Not even on the chance I'll be able to return to Brielle sooner. I've never been foolish enough to indulge in dreams of romance, but I know that necessity will drive me into the arms of some suitor eventually. After all, what other option do I have for getting both Brielle and me out from under Father's fist? Men have smiled my way upon occasion. In the last year alone, 3 brave fellows dared ask my father about me. He turned them all away with coarse words and threats, much to my secret relief. Someday, sooner rather than later, however, I'll have to take one of them. I know it. I'm not a fool. And when that time comes, I know what will be expected of me. The duties of a wife to her husband. Until then... I straighten my shoulders and lift my chin. I'll do what I can, I say. Only that, nothing more. For a little while longer, we sit there, the shadow and I, silent. I breathe in the perfumed air, watch the dance of the golden fish beneath the floating lilies, and try not to look at my companion. What is he thinking? Maybe I am entirely off in my guesses. Maybe he's secretly laughing at me. Or maybe I'm not imagining that sense of gratitude. Like a hum in the atmosphere. Not quite felt, yet understood somehow. I stand abruptly, looking back the way I came. Without turning, I toss the words over my shoulder. If you would like to join me after dinner, I will look forward to your company. With this, I set off quickly, ducking under the sweeping flowered boughs and hurrying back to the house. 14. The goblins perform for my benefit again at dinner. They wear the little clothes I've made for them, not one of them correctly or with any sense of modesty, enthusiastically sticking them on whatever limbs or features strike their fancy at the moment. While I eat, they arrange themselves in increasingly complex, acrobatic configurations, culminating in a pyramid 15 goblins high, with the last, tiniest goblin balancing on the tip of the enormous nose of the goblin beneath him. Then, one of the goblins at the base sneezes. I burst out laughing as the whole structure topples down and the little men roll, scramble, hop, and fly out of sight. Ellie arrives at the end of the performance, her expression disapproving. She still wears the green gown I made for her, which looks limp and the worse for wear following her cleaning of the bathing chamber. She clears the plates and platters away, chirping derogatory comments and kicking or swiping at any goblin men who happen to come within her view. You don't have to clean up after me, you know, I say, rising and trying to take a plate from the green woman. You can show me where everything goes and I'll do it myself. I'm quite used to looking after my own needs. Ellie gives me one of her blankest, most uncomprehending stares. Then she firmly pulls the plate from my grip and marches away through the colonnade, disappearing into some part of the house I have yet to explore. With a sigh, I turn to the corridor leading back to my own room. My stomach flutters, nervous excitement mingled with the never fully banished fear. Will Lord Damaris accept my invitation to join me tonight? Seven gods, what were you thinking? I mutter, hurrying from the courtyard. I made the invitation on pure impulse, but what will I do if he actually shows up? Talk to him, of course. It's that simple, really. I'm going to talk to him. I won't overtly question him about the curse, if curse there truly is. But in conversation, I might be able to pick up clues and hints, more pieces of this puzzle. If I can put it together sooner rather than later, break the curse in a few days, then perhaps I can go home long before the year and a day term is up. I hasten down the passage, alight with the last bits of sunlight shining through the colored panes of glass. I pause, looking up at one of the windows, the image of the pale queen and the dark man locked in a passionate embrace beneath three suns and three moons. Something about that scene strikes me as odd, but for the moment, I can't say what or why. Three suns, three moons. Do they symbolize the passing of 3 days and three nights, or... One hand creeps up to my face, lightly touching first one cheek, then the other. I remember the startling sensation of lips pressed against my skin and flesh warmly. Three kisses, my so-called bridegroom had said, part of a traditional Eledrian wedding night. And then I must wait until you ask me to kiss you a fourth time. A little shiver runs down my spine. I turn away from the window and hurry on to my room. It's already getting dark, so I quickly speak the fire to life before heading to the bathing chamber to wash my face and hands. The touch of water soothes me, and I return to the bedroom in a quieter frame of mind. After all, Lord Damaris had visited me several times now without once bringing up the matter of the fourth kiss. Even if it is the means to breaking the curse, I don't think he'll push it. Not yet, anyway. I sit in my usual chair. Not liking to let my thoughts run wild, I take up a bit of sewing and concentrate on the seams until my eyes grow too tired to focus. Then I lean back in my chair, idly watching the moonfire flames as they dance across but never consume the white stones. Their light slowly dims. The door opens. My heart gives a painful thud. A thrill races through my veins. I pick up the little silk jacket I was working on and pretend to study it, though it's far too dark to see anything properly. "Good evening, my lord," I say without lifting my face.
"Good evening, milady."
He takes his usual seat across from me and is silent. I continue to fiddle with the tiny jacket, hoping my shaking hands aren't too obvious by the low firelight. My mind spins, trying to think of something to say, some sort of conversation that would be both safe and revelatory. "I suppose you must," I begin. In the same moment, he says,
"I fear there is."
We both stop. Then I blurt in, "I'm sorry." Over the top of his,
"I beg your pardon."
Another silence follows until I whisper, "Do continue, please." He clears his throat.
"I was only going to remark that I fear there is little use in making clothes for the goblins. They are notoriously averse to clothing. There was a time, you see, when they were kept as pets by the Fae, dressed up as dolls and made to perform tableaus for the entertainment of great lords and ladies. Since those days, goblins refuse to wear clothing. They view it as a form of enslavement."
My mouth drops open. I look down at the tiny garment in my hands, then hastily set it aside. "I had no idea. I thought, well..."
"You thought I did not provide for the care of my own servants?"
"No. Well, yes. Well..." I swallow and frown. "Have I offended them?"
"Not that I have noticed,"
my shadow companion replies.
"They do like gifts, and they get jealous easily. When they saw you making garments for Yulalili, they were much enraged at first. They came to me with loud complaints, and though I reminded them of their own stance on clothing, they were determined to be unreasonable. But then your gifts began to arrive, and they cheered immediately."
He leans forward in his seat, as though to press a point home.
"Your generosity was well thought of and well received. I merely meant to advise you not to worry over much if they don't value the garments themselves or wear them correctly."
"Ah." I pick at the tiny sleeve I've been painstakingly fitting into an armhole. "Well, perhaps I'll think of something else they would like better." I shoot a quick glance across to him. "What about Ellie? Have I offended her?"
"Ellie?"
There's a momentary, puzzled silence. Then,
"You mean Yulilili? No, you could not have pleased her better if you'd tried. Though I would not expect her to begin wearing clothing on a regular basis."
"No." I shake my head and chuckle softly. "No, I've come to accept that already. She is a free spirit."
"That is one way of putting it, yes."
"Has she been with you long?"
"She has served the Damaris family for 600 years.
600? I stop and bite my lips. Of course, the Fae live and experience time very differently from humans. "And how long have you known her?"
205 years as of this summer. She was my... I'm not certain how you would put it. Nursemaid, perhaps? Your nursemaid? 205 years ago? I nod slowly, pondering this revelation. You're old. A great bark of a laugh erupts from the shadows across from me. I jump and grip the arms of my chair again, every hair on my head rising.
Pardon me, the shadow says hastily. I did not mean to frighten you. I am not used to interacting with your kind. Humans, I mean. I must indeed seem quite ancient to you. I almost fear to ask your age.
A lilt at the end of his last statement implies a question, even though he does not overtly ask it. I clear my throat. I was 18 last autumn. I suppose from your perspective that must make me something of an infant.
Indeed, comes the dry reply. A toddling babe, still very much in need of Yulilili's care.
Is he teasing me? It doesn't seem possible that a voice that deep and dark could speak so lightheartedly. I bite back a smile. Is that why you assigned her to me? Because you think I'm a child?
Certainly not.
The shadow chuckles again.
I may know little of humans, but I have sense enough about me. I can see that you are young, yes, but a woman grown, both in age and experience.
Not much experience, I think grimly, but don't say it aloud. Instead, I say, regardless, I'm glad to have Ellie. She has been kind to me. Very patient.
She speaks highly of you as well.
My eyebrows rise slightly. You discuss me?
Yes. She reports to me each night. Her primary duty is to see to your comfort.
Another silence follows this statement. After several breaths, he speaks again.
You have been comfortable, I trust.
Yes. I purse my lips and look down at my hands again.
My people have treated you well, accommodated your needs and wants.
I nod. What's the point in reiterating the hard truth that it doesn't matter how attentive his servants are? It doesn't matter how many comforts they offer, how I have only to speak a wish to have it granted with alacrity. I'm still a prisoner, a favored pet in a gilded cage. The fire on the hearth jumps and dances, the low flames playing along the glowing white stones. A silver filigree screen shields the blaze, prevents any trailing skirt from singeing. The light shining through it casts intricate, lacy patterns on the hearth. I watch the effect, idly wondering what it would be like to pick such a shadow off the ground and sew it to the edge of a garment. I shake my head and close my eyes. What am I doing? If I'm going to sit here in company with this person, I need to make use of the time. Can I mention the curse again? I spoke of it overtly in the garden, but he was nothing more than a phantom impression then. It might not even have been him at all. Though the fact that he's visiting me now after a week-long absence implies that it was Lord Damaris's shadow I spoke my invitation to this afternoon. But how to bring up the topic of the curse without directly addressing it? If I'm correct in believing he can't talk about it for fear of repercussions, then it's up to me to find ways to work the conversation back around to it, to subtly gather information. Heroines in legends and tales of fairyland always find clever means to gain the clues they need to solve their predicaments. I chew the inside of my cheek and frown. I'm not clever. I never have been. I've never had the time to be clever. I work hard, I survive, and I care for my sister. That requires no cleverness, just grim determination day after day after day. Brielle is the clever one. She always rushed to the town square when wandering bards passed through town, soaking in the stories and songs. She returned home in the evenings to fill my ear with garbled versions of what she heard, and I tried to patiently listen with half an ear. But my mind was always much more focused on the needs of the moment, leaving me little patience for fairy tales.
If only I'd paid better attention.
Why do you not make garments for yourself?
I start upright in my seat and glance across at the shadow. I'd been so taken up with my own thoughts, I'd not realized how long the silence lasted between us. I beg your pardon?
I cannot help but notice that you have yet to try on the various gowns provided for you,
he says.
At first, I feared you did not like them, and I thought to find other choices that would please you better. But then you began creating new garments for Ilulili and the goblins. I gather that the pleasure of refashioning the gowns pleases you more than the gowns themselves. And yet, you make nothing for yourself, only for others.
I think of the gold velvet dress, which I stuffed into the bottom of the clothing chest, along with the unwanted assortment of jewels. Several times during the last week, I considered changing into it following one of my luxurious scented baths. Every time, something inside me had balked. It's too great a temptation. If I give in, if I allow myself the enjoyment of such a gown, how quickly will my other defenses break down? How long until I forget the truth that I am a prisoner, held against my will, that I should be fighting with everything I have for my freedom? I glance at the shadowy darkness where I think his face might be. I moisten my dry lips and continue in a carefully steady voice. I am simply not used to sewing for myself. Back before, I worked in a dressmaker's shop.
Ah.
He seems to contemplate this for some moments.
Yes, I remember glimpsing something of that fact. It was mostly shadows to my vision, but I thought perhaps I saw you working your magic.
My magic? I snort, only just stopping myself from laughing outright. I am no magic user. A short silence follows this. Then,
are you sure?
Quite sure, yes. I'm merely a stitch girl in Mistress Petrin's shop. She occasionally calls me up front to deal with a difficult fitting, and I've a knack for drape and an eye for a flattering silhouette. But there's nothing magical about that. If it's a magician you need, I fear your scrying glass has sorely misled you. I flush and turn away, looking into the darkness on the far side of the fire. Seven gods. I hadn't meant to say that last part out loud. The words ring in the silence of the chamber, sounding sharper than they had when falling from my lips. Then again, why should I try to hide my anger? Even if there is a curse, even if Lord Damaris is desperate for someone to rescue him, does that give him the right to steal me away from my world, my family? Besides, I still don't know if there is a curse at all. This whole conversation might merely be another layer of Fae game-playing, a way for him to toy with his prey.
The Starglass is never wrong.
His voice rumbles softly, almost inaudible above the crackle of the fire. I shiver and pick at the bright threads embroidering the arm of my chair. Why, oh why, did I invite him to visit me this evening? I should have left well enough alone. I'm ill-prepared to match wits with a being nearly 200 years my senior, brimming with magic and menace and knowledge far beyond my understanding. For a long while, we simply sit. I eventually turn back to the fire and watch again the play of light and shadow through the filigree screen. I feel his gaze on the side of my face and take care not to let my expression betray emotion. Another few moments, and I will ask him to leave. Not too soon, though, or I might come across as frightened. That I cannot bear.
Are you familiar with the origins of your name?
I blink, once more glancing sideways at his inscrutable bulk. Yes, I say slowly. Yes, my mother named both of us for heroines of old. My sister is called after a famous huntress, who was said to run wild with wolves on winter nights and could hit the crescent moon with arrows of silver. As for me, I laugh softly. I was named for a barbarian queen who...
who took up an iron sword and drove the Fae from your land in ancient days, long before the pledge. Another rush of heat floods my cheeks. I duck my face, letting locks of hair fall like a veil, shielding me from his scrutiny. Queen Valera of yore is always depicted in stone or paint with the severed head of an elven king under her foot. She's quite the grim heroine, but well-loved throughout the kingdom in all her gory glory. My sister's name suits her well, I say with a half-smile. Mine not at all. I am no warrior queen. He doesn't answer. I feel something in the air, in the darkness, as though he's thinking a thought so strong in response to what I've said that it almost makes itself understood despite his determined silence. In the end, however, I can no more guess at his thoughts than I can read the mind of a statue. What of your name? I ask after a little. I let my lip shape the word softly. Aralas.
I am named for a wind, a soft, gentle breeze.
My eyebrow rises slightly. His name sounds even less suited to him than Valera is to me.
My mother told me, he continues, that while the hurricane brings destruction, the Aralas carries healing to the stricken land.
Until that moment, I wouldn't have thought it possible for a dark, dangerous voice like his to sound so gentle. Are you a bearer of healing, my lord? I ask with only the faintest trace of irony.
Not thus far in my life, but it is a goal toward which I strive.
He stops, and I hear his robes rustling as he shifts in his seat.
I am still young, after all. Perhaps there will be time.
Young? I frown. Comparatively speaking, how old would 205 years be considered to human age? The question springs to my tongue, but I bite it back. Instead, I ask, is your mother still living?
No, she was killed when I was a child.
The gentleness is gone. His voice holds the stone-hard tone that sends shivers straight to my core. I wince, wishing I'd held my tongue. There's a story here, but I don't pry. Not yet. Maybe later. I say quietly, my mother died as well, when I was a young girl and my sister a new baby.
I am sorry.
Yes, me too. I draw a long breath. My father is still living.
You are blessed, then.
I restrain a snort. What of yours?
I have no memory of my father.
Oh, did he? I hesitate, uncertain how much information I dare press for. Then again, what can hurt? Did he die before you knew him?
No.
At first, I don't think anything more will be forthcoming. The silence is long and painful, giving me time enough to wish I could take back such a thoughtless question. I open my mouth, hoping to offer an apology. But suddenly he's speaking again, his words flowing in a great rush as though afraid they'll be stolen away before he can get them out.
I gave up all memory of my father for a chance to look in the starglass. The price of such visions is steep, and I was desperate.
I gape into the dark space where he sits. Before I can think of a response, he continues.
He is dead, though. I know that much. Along with my elder brother, my three uncles, my grandfather and his brothers. All the men of my line.
This is it. My heart lurches to my throat, beating fast. I can't say how I know, but I do. This is the clue I've been searching for tonight. There is something in what he said, something I ought to understand. All the men of his line. Dead? The Fae do not die easily. Something happened to wipe out his family, to leave him the only surviving male of his name. Is this why he needs a bride? To continue the family line? No, that can't be right. He promised not to touch me, to return me to my father's house in a year,
so I can't be intended for childbearing. Something else, then. But what? Suddenly, the figure on the seat rises. I recoil into my chair. A powerful awareness of his size comes over me. I feel terribly small, frail.
"You are tired," he says. "I will leave you now."
Yes. I sit up a little straighter, lift my head, and nod slightly. Thank you for the pleasure of your company this evening. The words are simple enough, a polite sentiment spoken unthinkingly. But I feel shock in the atmosphere, hear his sharp intake of breath. I blink hard and drop my gaze. I shouldn't have said that. Why can't I be more careful? His presence far too easily unnerves me, puts me at a disadvantage.
The pleasure was all mine.
The shadow moves, and I glance up in time to catch what I believe to be a deep, graceful bow.
Milady.
My lord, I respond softly. He turns and crosses the room. The door opens in response to some unspoken command, and for a moment, I see his silhouette framed in the doorway. Gods above, but he is enormous. His head very nearly touches the lintel. And are those horns? Or is my mind playing tricks on me? The door shuts. I nestle back into the chair and watch the moonfire burn lower and lower, waiting for my heartbeat to steady. I mull over what he said, trying to see it from different angles. His mother killed. The men of his line, all dead. It must be important. It must connect to my situation. But how? At last, I rise and move to the bed. I remove my outer dress and climb into the soft blankets, lying on top of them, for the room is pleasantly warm and there's no need for a covering. I lay staring up at the ceiling overhead. My fingers play idly with the front laces of my shift. Is it really all quite simple? If I invite Lord Damaris into my bed, would a single night be enough? Might I wake the next morning, the curse broken, free to return to my old life, to Brielle? For a few dangerous moments, I dare let my imagination lead me. I see myself bathed in moonfire light, rising from my chair by the hearth, approaching the featureless figure seated across from me, reaching out to him, finding his hand in the dark, drawing him up from his place and leading him away from the fire, deeper into the shadows. I imagine unlacing my gown, pulling the fabric back from my shoulders, letting the garment slide down over my hips until it pools on the floor around my feet. It wouldn't be so dreadful. The darkness is so deep, I'd hardly feel naked at all. Would he hesitate to reach out to me? To close the small space between us? To draw me into his arms? I close my eyes, remembering the three kisses on my wedding night, the gentle pressure of his lips against my forehead and both of my cheeks. At the time, I'd been shocked, terrified. Now I seem to feel that sensation again. His lips were full, soft. Not at all what one might expect from a monster bridegroom. How would they feel pressed against my mouth? And his hands. Those huge hands that enfolded mine when he knelt before me and gave me his name. His touch was cold. So cold. And I vividly remember the chilling sensation of long, sharp nails just grazing my skin. What would it be like for those hands to explore my trembling body, freezing my flesh with their touch? I shudder and roll onto my side, curling my knees up to my chest. It's too much. Too terrifying. I can try all I like to convince myself. But I'm simply not brave enough. There must be another way. There must be some other means of breaking this curse. I lie awake for a long time. 15.
The following morning, before I've even touched the breakfast of fruits and tiny, dainty eggs and pink shells that the goblins bring into my room, Ellie steps through the door with a bundle of lace in her arms. Tying my hair back with a bit of ribbon, I look around, surprised. "What is that?" Ellie trills something and sets the bundle down on the bed. I move to touch it, realizing as I do so that although the lace is pretty, delicate stuff, snowy white and soft, it's merely a wrapping. Something else lies inside. Curiously, I pull back the folds. A gasp of delight escapes my lips. Contained within the bundle is yard after yard of the most exquisite fabric. Pink and white and softer than silk. It's almost too beautiful to touch, too beautiful to look at. I put out a tentative, trembling finger and just barely run it along one fold. Then, working up my nerve, I lift the fabric, drawing it close to my face to study the weave. But I can't see how the threads have been woven together. It's like no other fabric I've ever seen, and yet it looks and feels familiar. Petals! I look up, meeting Ellie's blinking gaze and curiously waving antennae. It's made of flower petals! It's true. The cloth is made of the same flowers that bloom from the trees along my favorite walk in the garden. Only the day before, I ran my fingers through the bounteous blossoms, daydreaming what it would be like to make a dress out of something so soft and lovely. Had he read my mind? I blink, frown, and drop the fabric abruptly into the lace. "What is this, Ellie?" I ask, turning to the green woman. "A gift? A bribe?" Ellie burbles and trills, stroking the cloth with one many-jointed hand. She picks up a corner fold and holds it up to my face, nodding admiringly. I smile despite myself. "This is much too fine for someone like me." I push Ellie's hand gently away. "This is fit for a princess, a queen. But it is lovely." I drape the fabric over the end of the bed, where I can look at it while I eat my morning meal. I peel and pop the tiny eggs into my mouth and nibble the exotic fruits, all without tasting them. My mind is full, studying the way the soft petal folds drape, how the light catches and plays with the colors. Images appear in my head, intriguing silhouettes. If I were to gather a little here, tuck a little there, if I didn't fight the natural inclinations of the cloth, but worked with it, allowing the drape to fall just so. Setting aside the tray and my half-eaten breakfast, I wipe my hands and pick up the cloth, running it gently through my fingers. It's so incredibly delicate. By rights, it should fall to pieces, the fibers fraying at the first application of needle and thread. But when I make a few experimental stitches with one of my silver needles, the weave proves much sturdier than I expected. Magic, perhaps. For some while, I simply sit in my chair, holding the fabric, turning it this way and that. I lose all track of time as my mind wanders down different paths of possibility, envisioning gown after gown, adjusting the mental images, reimagining. At last, I call Ellie to me and convince the green woman to stand with her arms out as I drape the fabric across her willowy body, pinning it here and there and standing back to study the effect. Ellie bears this patiently for a quarter of an hour before her antennae begin to vibrate with irritation. "You're right," I say, plucking out the pins that hold the fabric in a gather at the green woman's right hip and left shoulder. I let the soft folds fall back into my arms, and the naked nymph steps free, shaking her head and stretching her arms as though liberated from chains. "It's not right on you," I admit. It's meant for me." I stand frowning down at the mounds of gently perfumed softness in my arms. Resistance still burns in my heart, but it fades in the light of the hotter, more urgent burn of inspiration. At last, as though succumbing to temptation, I shake my head and call out, "Bergabog!" A tremendous clatter, like a whole set of kitchen utensils tumbling downstairs, rattles in the chimney. Then a little naked figure somersaults out onto the hearth, springs upright, and waves trouser-clad ears at me. I gulp back a laugh, for the goblin gazes up at me with dignity, and I don't want to offend him. "Bergabog," I say, "I need something. A dress mold. A proper one, like what I had back in my shop." I narrow my eyes at him. Does he understand what I'm saying? It's impossible to tell. "Can you get one for me?" "Bergabogagagagog," the little man cries, raising one finger high in the air, as though declaiming a great truth. Then he bows, twirls, and darts away up the chimney. God only knows where he's going, or what he'll fetch back when he returns. Well, it's out of my hands now. I shrug, carefully draping the miraculous cloth over the end of my bed, select one of my chalks, and begin sketching concepts on the wall. The ideas seem to pour from my fingers faster than I can keep up with, and I scarcely notice Ellie's disapproving tuts and fussings behind me. A few hours slip past. I come out of a chalky daze of creativity to find a dress mold in the room behind me. It looks very much like the one I often used at Mistress Petrin's, and when I inspect it closely, I discover that it is indeed the same. There's the chip on the stand where a pair of dropped shears gouged the wood. I would recognize it anywhere. I smile with delight. "Thank you, Bergabog," I call to the empty air. Mistress Petrin will be baffled, no doubt, at the sudden disappearance of one of her molds. But she has others. She'll get by. Moving to pick up the lovely fabric, I pause abruptly and look down at my chalky fingers. This won't do. I hasten to the bathing chamber to wash my hands, and by the time I reemerge, Ellie's there, moving pins and shears to make room on the table for the platter of food she's brought. "Oh no, I don't have time to eat," I exclaim. The nymph shoots me a look that could curdle cream. I shut my mouth and obediently sit where she indicates. While Ellie presses breads, cheeses, and cold meats into my hands, I chew and swallow absently. My gaze travels between the chalk drawings on the wall to the fabric on the bed. I scarcely taste anything, and as soon as Ellie steps back and gives me room, I spring up and rush to the wall, making corrections on several of the sketches, crossing out several others with aggressive, determined strokes. Only then do I pull the mold closer to the window, take up the fabric, and begin a few experimental drapes. I smile. The day passes. Sunlight travels in colored patches across my floor and up the wall. Just as the light is beginning to fade, I make the first few tentative cuts with my shears. It's spine-chillingly terrifying to see the blades pass through that cloth, but I think, I hope, I believe I have it right. Finally. Exhausted, I set the shears aside and rub a hand down my tired face. The mold stands with fabric draped and pinned. To the untrained eye, it might look haphazard, ungainly, but the vision is begun. Ellie approaches and stands behind me, tilting her head from one side to the other as she studies my work. "What do you think?" I ask, rising from the floor and stretching my lower back. She burbles something and swings an arm around the room at the drawings, then points at her own green frock and chirrups. I guess at her meaning. "I knew exactly what I was doing with that gown and the others," I say. "I've used those fabrics before, or fabrics much like them. That's why they didn't take as long. But this is all new for me, and I want to get it right." I shrug and roll my stiff neck. It's not as though there's any rush. The moment the words are out of my mouth, I regret them. A weight falls on my heart. The smile on my face melts away. I allow Ellie to take my hand, to lead me from the room, down the passage to the courtyard where a meal is laid out for me. The goblin men serve me and dance for my entertainment, but I scarcely notice them. I eat, but the food tastes like dust in my mouth, and I struggle to swallow. What am I doing? What am I doing? The whole day passed, and I never thought about home. Not once. I never thought of Brielle, never stopped to wonder if my sister is even now plunging into Whispering Wood without a care for her own safety. I let my mind go wherever it wished, pursuing airy visions as they presented themselves to my imagination, becoming lost in my own little world. Anger burns in my breast. I return to my room and stand looking at the dress form and the lovely fabric for several long minutes, my pulse thudding in my ears. I had to take up those shears, tear into the cloth, rip it to shreds, and toss it from the room in tatters. My fingers twitch toward the table, and my mind urges me, do it, do it, do it. But my heart constricts painfully. My fingers curl tight, their nails driving into my palms. Then I grab the dress mold and drag it over the wall, close to the window. I drape the heavy curtain over form and cloth, covering them completely, hiding them from view. This done, I go to my chair, adjust its angle until I can't see the bulge in the curtains, and sit, my spine very straight, my hands folded on my knees. I call the moon fire to light, but only a tiny blaze. It soon burns down to a low glow, and the shadows in the room lengthen, deepen. The door opens. Lord Damaris steps inside and approaches the fire.
Milady.
I don't respond. With a wave of one hand, I indicate the chair opposite mine, then fold both hands tight on my lap. My shadowy bridegroom hesitates for the count of three breaths. Then he sits. I feel his gaze on the side of my face, but he doesn't break the silence. My lips are dry. I moisten them quickly, then turn and face the shadow. I am going to ask you a question, and I want you to answer me truthfully.
I will.
He pauses, then adds,
if I can.
A muscle in my jaw tenses. I draw a long breath through my nostrils. Aralas, I say. A frisson in the air between us. A spark moving from me to him and back again at the sound of his name. It's an odd sensation, so unlike anything else in my range of experience. But unmistakable. Undeniable. Aralas, I say. Why did you send me that cloth?
Do you not like it?
Answer my question. Silence fills the space between us. Silence, and that connection, that tension in the air. I brace myself, then lean into that sense. How I know to do so, I can't explain, but I do. I feel like a baby, newly discovering my own hands, learning how to flex my fingers, to grip, to hold. The shadow speaks again at last.
I wanted to give you something you would enjoy.
The words are carefully, almost reluctantly spoken.
The other gifts I provided were not well chosen. The jewels, which I had hand-selected from my mother's extensive collection, Yalilali tells me now reside in the bottom of your chest. The gowns, which I am told are fine examples of human fashions, have not been worn and are instead cut up to make new garments for nymphs and goblins. At first, I thought perhaps you were destroying them to spite me, but...
He stops a moment as though gathering his thoughts.
I realize now that it is the creation of beautiful things that pleases you, not the beautiful things themselves. Your joy is in your magic. So I thought to give you something of extraordinary beauty from which you might make something more extraordinary still.
My heart beats a little faster than before. There's something else, something he isn't saying. I take hold of that connection between us and pull. Go on, Aralas. He clears his throat.
The fabric I gave you, the silk woven from Ornthalis petals, is of fey make.
Humans have yet to discover the secret of spinning flowers into thread. I thought, perhaps it was foolish of me, but I thought if I could give you something you loved, but which you could not have in your own world, then maybe you would take some joy in your time here. Here in Oricon, I mean.
I stare at that shadowy form. His words ring in my ears. I feel the truth of what he says, dragged from his lips by the force of his name. Frowning, I duck my head. Resentment burns inside me because it worked. His little game. I spent the day in a creative frenzy, my passion for my work totally swallowing up all other thoughts and feelings. Never in my life have I experienced the joy of my craft as I did today. Satisfaction, yes. Interest and pleasure at seeing my ideas come together, certainly. But today there was so much more. I was consumed with excitement, with the possibilities suddenly at my fingertip, and intoxicated by the luxury of time in which to pursue those possibilities. Every thought was caught up in new ideas for shape and drape, in touching and experimenting with that incredible, impossible cloth, in stretching my own limited understanding to encompass whole new ranges of inspiration. I hardly stopped even to eat or drink, and resented the moments that dragged me away from the sheer joy of invention. If I'm honest with myself, if I'm brutally, painfully honest, I can scarcely wait for tomorrow to come, for the sun to rise so that I might once more pull the mold out from behind the curtain and continue seeing where the possibilities take me. Back home, there was no time for such feelings. Tears fill my eyes. How can I let myself think this way? Brielle is home. Yes, life is hard. The struggle of day-to-day existence enough to beat me black and blue. But Brielle is there, so that's where I ought to be as well. You tricked me, I say.
That wasn't my...
You tricked me into being happy. I clench my hands together, squeezing as hard as I can. I won't fall for it. I won't.
Please, Valera.
And there it is. That simmering power. That sensation like heat in the air. I gasp and lift my chin again, staring into the shadows across from me. I'd forgotten the connection goes both ways.
Please believe me, I did not intend the gift as a form of manipulation. I know this situation is difficult for you.
He shifts in his seat, and by the low glow of the firelight, I think I see him bow, resting his head in his hands, his elbows propped on his knees. When he speaks again, his voice is deeper than before, thickened with some emotion I cannot name.
I was so caught up in my own needs. I failed to consider how it would feel to you, to be plucked from your father's doorstep, like a wildflower falling to the hand of a thoughtless child. I thought I understood how humans worked. A gift or two, pretty gems, pretty gowns, a handful of gold for your trouble.
He draws a breath and releases it slowly.
Everything I thought I knew about humans is wrong. At least where you are concerned.
I don't speak. I look down at my hands, pale in the light of the blue fire. My pulse thuds in my temples, but I try to calm myself, to consider his words in the spirit in which they are intended. They're truthful, at least. I can feel how the bindings of his name prevent him from lying to me. A choice lies before me, a choice that makes my stomach knot. I can choose to see the gift as manipulation, an attempt to appease me, to make me docile and compliant. Or I can see it as an attempt to make my difficult situation a little less terrible, to shed a drop of light in the darkness. I open my mouth. Pause, almost swallow back the words. But what is the point of hiding? If you want to make me happy, you will let me go.
I know.
Yet you keep me here.
I must. But only for
a year and a day, I finish for him. Closing my eyes, I breathe in and out in a quiet, careful rhythm, counting to 10. The fabric is lovely, I say at last. The connection between us, that invisible something for which I have no name, quickens.
You like it?
Yes, very much.
I am glad.
And he is. I feel his gladness like a glow pulsing from the darkness surrounding him. My pleasure gives him pleasure in a way I hadn't realized was possible. It's terrifying. Hastily, I draw back from the connection, from the power of his name. I can't even say how I do it. It's magic of some sort, and I am no magic user. One moment, I feel that burning cord stretched across the space between us. The next, the sensation is gone, though I know the cord itself still exists. It always will, now that I possess his name. That doesn't mean I have to feel it. I swallow, my throat thick and tight. Good night, my lord, I say abruptly. He rises at once, as though in response to a command. I hear a little sound as he starts to say something, but stops himself.
Good night, my lady,
he says instead. He slips from the room without another word. 16. For 2 days, I work on the gown. I stitch and adjust and pin and drape. And slowly, slowly, the ideas in my head begin to manifest in reality. When fear freezes my hand, I pull one of the gowns from the chest, chop it to pieces, and use large swaths of cloth to make mock-ups, to see if the ideas leading me wildly down the road of inspiration are even feasible. But these mock-ups taunt me, for even when they work, they are only creations of ordinary silk or satin, nothing like the petal blossom fabric. I can't know for certain how it will turn out unless I am brave, unless I take risks. Then, one evening, it all comes crashing down. I've been hours at work, pleating along the waistlines of the pink gown, tiny, painstaking pleats, dozens of them, held together with silver pins. I'm so close to my work, and the vision in my head is so clear, so perfect, that I don't think to step back and check my progress until I've gone around the entire circumference of the waist. Only then, blinking and sore-shouldered, do I scoot back on my knees. I frown. I scoot a little farther. Stand. Turn my head to one side. Oh, great gods above. It's all wrong. It's all wrong. That night, I can't eat. Ellie tries to drag me out to the banquet table for supper, but I send her away with a growl and a wave of my hand. Instead, I kneel on the seat of my upholstered chair, my arms folded along the headrest, my chin resting on my elbows, and stare at the dress. The hideous, horrible abomination, with its awful pleats and its terrible silhouette, and it's... Oh, how I hate it! I bury my face in my arms, then slowly melt down into the chair, curling my knees up to my chest. Exhaustion aches through my limbs, throbs in my temples. I've spent too much time on this project over the last 3 days. It can't possibly be healthy. But how can I bear to leave it? It's meant to be something so wonderful, so exquisite. I can feel it. I can feel the shape just at my fingertips. Only I've gone and ruined the whole thing with those wretched, wretched pleats. I sink into a doze, not quite sleep, not quite wakefulness, merely a numb space of self-loathing and frustration, unlike anything I've ever felt before. The closest I've ever come to this feeling was 2 years ago, when Mistress Petrin gave me a chance to drape a lady's ball gown according to the latest trend for large, voluminous sleeves. During my work, I had a sudden burst of inspiration for a new silhouette that would go so well with the gown's basic lines, with the soft, shimmering fabric, with the lovely silver trim. How I longed to pursue that image so tantalizing and clear in my head. But I had my orders. The lady wanted voluminous sleeves. So voluminous sleeves she must have. I repressed that image, smothered it almost to death, and forced myself to do the work I was told to do. Ingenuity has no place in the work of a stitch girl in Mistress Petrin's shop. This feeling was much like that. That horrible, sick, helpless frustration. Only it was worse. 100 times worse. For this time, the constraint doesn't stem from Mistress Petrin's rules or the current strictures of fashion or a client's wishes. The only limitation to achieving my true vision now is me. I start at the sound, but don't sit up straight. Gods above, I'd not realized how dark the room had grown. Now I listen to the familiar sound of heavy robes dragging on the floor as my unseen bridegroom enters. He shuts the door softly and approaches me.
"M'lady," he says.
I grunt and wave a hand dismissively. My head is still pressed into the top of my knees, but I turn it to one side, gazing into the moon firelight. "M'lord," I mutter. He pauses. I can feel his gaze on me, can almost feel the concern simmering in an unspoken question on his lips. I hear him take a breath and start a few times to speak before finally settling on a safe,
"How has your work fared today?"
I growl. The sound is so raw and animal it surprises me. I sound almost like my father in one of his rages. The thought makes me grimace. But my tongue speaks before I can stop it. It's hopeless, hopeless and stupid, and I hate it, and I'm giving up. The words echo in Lord Damaris's silence. Oh, I must sound like a petulant child. This is certainly no way for a lady to behave. I give my head a shake, squeezing my eyes tight, and try to summon the will to sit properly, to drop my knees, lower my feet to the floor, straighten my skirts, fold my hands in my lap, and offer an apology for my unseemly words. But why bother? My jaw hardens. It's not as though I care what my kidnapper thinks of me. Do I? Of course not. I tighten my arms around my knees while my heart beats against my ribcage. Fabric rustles again. I listen to Lord Damaris move behind my chair, cross my room. He's going to look at the dress on its form. Oh, gods on high. Why didn't I tear the whole thing to bits before he got here? But it was so much work to get it this far, and even though the work is all wrong and I loathe the sight of it, the idea of pulling it all to pieces. No. No, I can't bear it. I wait in painful suspense. He's going to venture.